going. I'll be here in a second.
Talk to your, all of your friends that are on this committee and tell them if they don't get here, we'll have to start coming back at night. Nobody wants to do that. But we have to have so many people to open the proceedings. So I'm calling the meeting to order, even though we've had the many here, and they're we've let them go, but that's all right. We'll put them down as absent, but here. So, Representative Swatsky, can you move the minutes of whatever date they are? March 5th. Are there any questions regarding the minutes of March 5th? And if not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Passed. There weren't any opposed. I didn't hear any there, so. Okay, the first bill up is Representative Dortholt, which will tell us about ignition interlock programs.
You'll be back. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You want to move your bill, or Senator Doral?
Sure, I guess move to take it off the table and to refer as appropriate.
Well, you don't have to do anything at this juncture because we might not pass your bill.
Okay.
But when you get through and we do pass it, then you can make the motion.
All right. Oh, sorry. So, where we left off.
But we wanted you to say that your bill is here and we're ready to talk about it and you're ready, so that's why we ask you to move it.
So I'd like to move 2255.
Good. Well, tell us about it, please.
It's where we left off on last week. So that's the Ignition Interlock Program conforming changes. And I do have a couple other folks who are well in tuned to this issue to address the questions that members seem to have had last week. So with that, kind of resume to the questions we had, if there are any.
Well, you have some testifiers with you.
I do.
Two.
Introduce yourselves.
You want them to reflect on the bill, or what? What would you like?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jody Osperson. I am with the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety, Impaired Driving Coordinator.
And my name is Joan Kupczynski. I'm the Driver Services Director.
And you are going to give testimony, I believe.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. What House File 2255 is asking is just a technical fix to give authority to put canceled drivers on a limited license for the first year of the program. These are drivers who have been convicted of criminal vehicular operation.
Any questions? Anybody else that would like to speak? Representative Newberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to echo kind of where I left off last time. Representative Dorholt, I'm not questioning your motives or your intent to try to help folks get their license. This is not a hard issue at all. My concern, as I said last week, my concern stems from the best example I could give is if both you and I went to a bar, we both became intoxicated. We both drove our cars home. I hit a pedestrian, and that person ended up a quadriplegic for the rest of their life, and you hit a pedestrian and killed that person. I would have the ability to get a limited driver's license back, whereas you would not. I'm having a real hard time reconciling that. And that's, I guess at this point, you know, I understand that the argument is to try to get folks back to work. Get them, back into society, get them, interacting, getting going to and from the places they need to go. But I think that that's a decision that they forfeited when they chose to drink and drive and cause great bodily harm, substantial bodily harm, or bodily harm as a result of their actions. There is public transportation. If people need to get to work, there are other means, and I think that that's just a natural consequence of a choice that they made. As I said before, I would like to support this, but at this time I just can't, given my background as an emergency medical provider of 26 years, and seeing the end result of people being hit by cars, trucks, and you name it, if it's got wheels, they've been hit by it. So I guess that's, I just wanted to reiterate my comments and where I stood on that. Thank you for your time.
Representative Seltzer.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Dorhold, I just had a clarifying question. Isn't it already the law, whether, and I really appreciate your experience and your comments, Representative, but isn't this just a technical fix? Isn't it already the law? That's already the law, so we're not voting on, that's a very large and touchy issue today, we're just voting on this technical fix, isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to respond to representatives' concerns. Ignition interlock actually is for the motoring public. It's a safety feature. It keeps a person from getting in a car and driving drunk. If you're at a level of 0.02 or higher, that car won't start. Currently, that research nationally shows that drivers that are revoked, suspended, or canceled drive, 70% of them drive illegally. What we're trying to do, a part of Ignition Interlock, is to ensure that these people can get on a limited license. It is a technical fix, but part of Ignition Interlock is to keep everyone else that isn't driving intoxicated safe on the roadways. So it is a safety feature.
Any other questions or comments? Well, if not, I think we should, you can make the recommendation now that your bill be referred to the General Register.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that HF 2255 be referred to the General Register.
All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you. Representative Seltzer. Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd like to recommend that we refer House File 2481 to Education Finance. And I also have a couple of amendments, if I might offer those to get the bill into the shape I would like it. I'd like to move the A14 and the A3 amendment.
One at a time.
What?
One at a time.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Okay.
I'd like to move the A14 amendment, which clarifies the issue around a child being left unattended on a school bus after a post-trip inspection being a misdemeanor.
We're going to vote on your amendment. Does anybody have any objections? Otherwise, all in favor of A140807 be attached to the bill. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. And your next amendment.
The next amendment is the H2481A3 amendment, Chair Earhart.
Are there any questions about that? You have it in front of you. It's a two-liner. If not, all in favor of attaching that to the... where is the bill? Here we are. House File 2481, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All All opposed? Now you've got that passes, and you have your bill now with as amended before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to, I'm going to make a few comments, and then we're fortunate here to have Lieutenant Brian Reed, who will be testifying for us today. We all want our children to be transported to and from school and school-related activities safely, regardless of whether they are transported in the traditional big yellow buses we see, or the smaller Type 3 vehicles that carry 10 or fewer students. And in your packets, you should have illustrations of Type 3 vehicles. Although there are many good safety standards already in place, there are currently some significant omissions in the statute governing these Type 3 vehicles that transport some of our students, and I am going to ask Lieutenant Ree to talk about those omissions and what the bill does to repair them.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Brian Rue with the State Patrol Office of Pupil Transportation. I'll just kind of walk through the bill here, starting at the beginning with where we're going. Under Section 1, every year students are left unattended in school buses, and with our extreme varying climates that we have, that can be a huge safety concern that we'd like to address. We were proposing here to put it into statute and make a requirement that the drivers conduct a post-trip inspection of the school buses to make sure that no kids are left on the bus unattended. This year, up in the Bemidji area, we had a bus broke down as the heaters quit working on one of those extremely cold days, below zero temperatures, and they brought a spare bus to pick up the kids, and the bus that was broken down went back to the garage and was left outside for an hour. At that point, they pulled it inside for the repairs. Nobody started working on it for another hour. When they went back out there at that point, so 2 hours after the bus had broken down, they see movement in the bus and see a child wandering around inside the bus. Clearly, with the dangerously cold temperatures, that can be a huge safety concern for students. Another instant, a bus had returned back to the garage in the metro area here with a six-year-old that had fallen asleep. And in this case, there's a video of the bus, and you can see the driver completing her paperwork for the end of the day. And this particular bus had a child safety check system on it. So it required the driver to walk to the back of the bus, push the button to deactivate the alarm, and walk back to the front of the bus. Well, in the video, you can see there's a hood and a child sitting in one of the seats, and the driver walked by the child on the way back to push the alarm and back by the child again to get off the bus. She gets her stuff and gets off the bus. Clearly, she went through the motions of deactivating that alarm but didn't check for the child. About 45 minutes later, that child wakes up, tries to figure out how to get off the bus, and is unable to open the door. Starts pushing buttons inside the compartment and actually release the emergency brake. The bus was on a flat area, so it didn't roll anywhere, but the child was still unable to get out. He remembered his training from bus evacuation, so he opened the side emergency exit and fell to the ground. And as he was wandering through the parking lot, somebody else heard him crying, and the kid wasn't sure where he was and was scared. So we just want to eliminate these situations. And those are just two examples from this year. We have some other ones, too. So that's why we think it's important to put in there that to make it a requirement rather than just a company policy. The next section is Section 2, refers to our post-trip inspections. Every school bus is required to be inspected by the State Patrol annually, and then we also do random inspections. If we would put a bus out of service and the company would then try to use it without repairing the violations, we're just proposing to make that a gross misdemeanor offense. We have had cases of companies doing that, whether they couldn't get the part or didn't want to wait to have a mechanic take a look at it before they put the bus back into service. Currently, there is nothing in statute that we could use if that violation was to occur. That was actually under Section 3. Apologize for that. Section 2 was related to the same thing, addressing the penalty levels for that violation versus the other violations of 169.451. Uh, under Section 4, this is where we're talking about the differences between the Type 3 vehicles and the large buses. As you can refer to the handout, the Type 3s are what would be considered the smaller vehicles, your passenger cars, vans, SUVs, anything other than your traditional yellow school buses. The National Congress on Student Transportation kind of sets out a recommended design specifications for all school buses in the nation. We have adopted those in Minnesota, but that just pertains to the large buses. One of those requirements is that large buses be equipped with a seatbelt cutter in case the bus was on its side or on its roof and the driver was unable to press the release button to get out. The seatbelt cutter is specific. It has to be a closed handle so the driver can't cut themselves in a protected blade. And I actually have some examples here today we can pass around just so you can see that it's not really an object or an item that the kid can get a hold of and hurt themselves with, but it is designed to cut the seatbelt should need be. The reason we want that on Type 3 is, one, just to make it consistent with what's required on the large buses. And these cost about $7 a piece, so we don't feel it's a huge burden on the industry or the school districts. And two, large buses really typically, the only seatbelt in a large bus would be for wheelchair restraints or for the driver's seat. A lot of buses aren't equipped with seatbelts, where your passenger vehicles all have seatbelts, so you'd be more likely to potentially need a webbing cutter such as that. So that's why we feel that that's important, again, just to make it consistent and to eliminate any confusion between the different types of buses. Section 5 kind of goes back to our child left behind or unattended child left on the bus legislation about the failure to conduct the post-trip inspection reporting. With the amendment that was accepted, this requires that the district or carrier report the violation to the Office of Pupil Transportation or Director of Pupil Transportation, which would be me, within 72 hours, just so we can follow up on these cases and see what happened and what went wrong and why the kids were left unattended. Section 6 moves on to the exceptions for Type 3 drivers. Again, this was just kind of an omission in statute when they put in these requirements for the Type 3 drivers. Currently, all commercial drivers are required to report moving violations or whether they've been convicted of any loss of license, revoked, suspended, canceled. And we just want to make sure that the Type 3 drivers are consistent and that they also have to report to their carrier or district if they lose their driver's license so they aren't continuing to operate without a valid driver's license. And then Section 7 is, again, with the unattended child. We're looking to make it a disqualifying offense to leave a child unattended on a school bus. If the child is actually left with on the bus after the trip, the post-trip inspection was completed or the driver failed to do a post-trip inspection, that the driver would lose their license or their school bus endorsement for 1 year. Again, that's just their school bus endorsement, not their regular driver's license, not their commercial driver's license, not their passenger endorsement. So it just would take the school bus endorsement off for 1 year. They could still drive for a public transit agency or motor coaches or anything like that. And that's kind of just kind of a walkthrough of what our proposals are and what we're looking to accomplish with this bill. And I'd like to thank Representative Seltzer for carrying our DPS's initiative. Any questions for me?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman. Can I have just a clarifying question on the first page under Section 2? I wasn't sure exactly what you said. Did you say Section 2 had to do with the inspection of buses? And if that was the case, who would be charged with a violation of a gross misdemeanor? The school district, or who would be involved with that?
That's referring to Section 2 and 3 are kind of related. Section 2 is specifically clarifying what the charge or the level of offense would be. So sub 6, which is a reference as being a gross misdemeanor, would be charged to whoever allowed that illegal operation. So if the shop manager told the bus driver, we don't have the part, take it out and use it, then they would be the ones to be charged, or if the driver just made the determination if they're at a sporting event and we put the bus out of service or something and they just use it without repairing the vehicle, then they would be the ones that would be charged.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair. And again, the question becomes then, if this person was directed by somebody above them to not allow this, or their funding wasn't available to get the part done, is that something that would be passed on above, or is he kind of hung out to dry for that?
Mr. Chair, or representative members of the committee, it would basically be on our investigation or what we can find, who made that decision, and that's who we would be looking to charge the violation with, the person responsible for allowing that to continue or happen.
Representative Mazin.
Okay. Mr. Chair, whoever would like to respond to this. I know that one of the bus companies in my district has the provision that their drivers have to go on board to the end of the bus to make sure there's nobody there. But what you're saying, that second illustration is that person did it and they still missed the child?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason,
sure.
And members, yes. And the video does show that. You can see in the video and hear that the alarm is going off. I reminded the driver to walk back and push that button, and that's what she did. She pushed the button, but didn't actually look for the child and left the child on the bus.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Lieutenant, this may be more of a curiosity question, but what is a Head Start vehicle described in statute? What is it, and how is it different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, and members of the committee, it is defined under the definition. 169011 does define a Head Start vehicle. They're included in our annual inspection process, but there are some differences based on some federal requirements between the Head Start agencies and state school bus regulations.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Oh, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Mr. Kelleher.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm representing the Minnesota School Bus the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. I would like to thank, first of all, Representative Seltzer, who I've spoken with a couple of times. About the bill, the department's housekeeping bill, and as well to the State Patrol, because we've been trying to figure out a way to make this kind of work for everybody. And the amendment that you adopted does some of that. Our concerns are basically in and around the post-trip inspection. In the last page of the bill, or the second to last page of the bill, is where the revocation for a year for the S endorsement as a school bus operator. We think that that's really a long time, and in some respects, we believe that even as I said in the other body, that if it was, which is our preference, you know, some level of 30, 60, or 90 days is as appropriate as a year, because in some respects, this person's probably never going to come back in the bus industry at all anyway. So, I mean, it's an employment problem. And we certainly recognize the severity of this issue and the tragic nature of leaving students on a bus, and especially overnight, which has, unfortunately, has been a couple of the examples. In lieu of that, or in addition to that, one of the things that we're trying to suggest is what are the parameters of when a driver fails to do a post-trip inspection? Is it, you know, I'm 2 feet off the bus and I go, I forgot to go do my post-trip inspection, you turn around, you walk right back on the bus. Is that a failure? And what are the things that we're talking about, or is an hour a failure, you know, that sort of thing. And one of the things we're trying to suggest is a 15-minute time window from when the driver would actually either be reminded by their supervisor or have it, you know, come to their conclusion that they failed to do a post-trip inspection. And then they have that 15-minute window of opportunity to go back and do the inspection. Because I think that's what we're all talking about, is having the inspection actually done. As was said, the companies I represent are trying very hard through all kinds of mechanisms to make sure that buses are empty when they're in the bus garage. Some of the companies have a sign that the driver must turn over that says the bus has been walked through and is empty. As the lieutenant said, some companies are utilizing these safe student buttons where you walk to the back of the bus and push the button before you can exit the bus or the alarms go off. Not everything is foolproof, but we're trying to find mechanisms to make sure this doesn't happen. And as I said, we're trying to find a window to where you're not just stepping on the bus. And, you know, and quite frankly, in all common practice, the State Patrol is not going to be in the bus garage, you know, going, oh, you know, it's been 7 minutes and you haven't, you know, done your post-trip inspection. The other thing that I think I'd like to bring up is I think it's part of the amendment on Amendment A140807, line 113, a violation of this subdivision is a misdemeanor, and I believe that that failure to conduct a post-trip inspection reporting would put the misdemeanor on any carrier or district. I'm not a lawyer, and I think most people in this room know that, but I don't know of, and I'm certainly willing to be enlightened, that other actions of another person causes another entity to be caused to have a misdemeanor. The carriers, I sort of understand, you know, we're the supervisor, but even still, is it the responsibility of the carrier to get a misdemeanor for the failure of an employee to perform an act which they're vigorously trying to train all their employees to do? And I won't speak for the school districts, but I don't think they want a misdemeanor attached to the school district. I'm not even sure how you do that. So I think those are my main comments. You know, obviously this is an issue that we don't like to have happen ever, but we are asking the committee to consider a lesser suspension than a year and to provide, like I said, a window of opportunity, some parameter after the bus stopped back in the bus garage for the bus driver to go. I should have gone and checked, you know, whether that's 10 minutes or 15 minutes. Obviously an hour is something we're not talking about. But we think a short window of opportunity would be a better solution. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sure. Representative Seltzer, do you have any response to Mr. Kelleher's concerns?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, you're right. The State Patrol is not there timing them or watching to see if you come off the bus without doing an inspection. The real teeth in issue and what happens is if a child is left unattended on the bus. And to me, if a child is left unattended on a bus for 15 minutes and it's 20 degrees below zero, I think we don't want that. We just don't want that to happen. And I think rather than taking this person's license away forever, I think a year is a fair consequence. Oh. When you think about the consequence, what the consequence could have been to the child.
Representative Runberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, just thinking about, you know, the different variables that could be involved, it does seem a little too simplistic, it seems to me. I mean, perhaps if the driver, you know, had forgotten for an hour and more due to, let's say, consumption of alcohol, you know, some other factors, then you would sort of say, yeah, maybe we look at something more severe. But I think it's difficult to get for districts to get school bus drivers. I think that the retraining and the training costs involved, you know, to have them up to speed, you know, maybe costs that should be weighed. I mean, I would hope you would talk with Mr. Kelleher and consider, you know, something more moderated in terms of the penalty. You know, or if there's other levels, other factors that might warrant something more, you know, more severe. But a 1 year, I mean, that is a loss of job, I think. It involves a lot of costs and a lot of retraining, and, you know, I think those things ought to, you know, that's be more reasonable, I would think, to consider thinking about this a bit.
Officer?
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on some of the comments that have been made. We're talking about leaving a child unattended on a bus. The child is exposed to the elements, They're scared. They're, you know, petrified when they're found. And to me, we feel that there really shouldn't be a set time. We feel that whether the driver's off for 5 minutes and goes inside to have a cup of coffee, at that point the child wakes up and wanders off the bus. Now they're exposed to the elements again, an unfamiliar area. They wander off, their traffic hazards, stranger hazards, and that can happen at any amount of time. We feel that this check needs to be done before the driver leaves the vicinity of the bus. As a parent or anybody else, if you got somebody watching your kid, I don't think they would feel it'd be appropriate to leave them in a car and walk into the gas station or Walmart for 5 minutes and leave the kid out in the vehicle. I think that they'd be expected to take care of that child. And I don't think it is too much expected the driver does their job. And it, like I said, it is a company policy that they do conduct those inspections, so the driver should be trained and harped on that to begin with. And I drove school bus for 2 years, and I know the company I drove for, it was very adamant that you conduct the post-trip inspection. And I did that part-time while with the State Patrol, and as that, I certainly didn't want to have the embarrassment of having a child be found on my bus, so I made sure to clearly walk through the bus and look under each seat. And it doesn't take that an ordinary amount of time to make that check. I don't think it's unrealistic to expect the drivers to be responsible for somebody else's children.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
I don't think the new requirement is at all unreasonable either. But Mr. Chair, will this bill go on to another committee?
It's going
because
to,
it has penalties in it.
Education Finance.
So it wouldn't be to Judiciary to talk about a penalty?
Here, or do you want to do it at Finance? We can do it right
well,
here.
Maybe Finance can take it up there.
Well, what's your preference? Would you like to move it ahead and work with whoever you might be working with to maybe change your mind if you think it should be changed, or not if you don't?
Well, certainly if this issue comes up in Education Finance, we can also talk about it, and I certainly do want to be reasonable. However, there are actually few infractions annually, which is a real tribute to our bus drivers, but I do feel that if you leave a child unattended on a bus, I mean, one child released a brake. Fortunately, it was a flat surface. I feel there should be a consequence that should be in the back of people's minds.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the airlines don't have this problem. I'm not trying to make fun of it. But, Mr. Kelleher, I have a question, and it's going to be kind of an obvious one, and it's the follow-up question. Number one is before, actually, did the bus companies have a policy to screen the buses prior to this latest incident?
Mr. Chairman, yes, very much so. Either the mechanical, or I think they're electric, the button in the back of the bus. And we have, and I think Lieutenant Rue can speak to this almost a little better than I can, but the State Patrol does what's called train the trainer, where they come in and train one of our employees to train the other employees about updates in the law and what's current in law and what's a requirement to, as a bus driver. And it's a lot, let alone the sort of clean living lifestyle you must maintain, because you can't have substances in your bloodstream. And sure, I can't do it at work. And one thing I suppose I'd like to say, too, if you just allow me, I mean, I think almost all the bus companies that I represent have a heated bus garage. So, I mean, the child left in the cold part, I think we shouldn't think of that as every incident. And we transport millions of student transportation miles every year. And this is statistically almost immeasurable, however awful it is, and we don't want to have this happen. I mean, our bus companies do not want to be in the newspaper for this sort of activity whatsoever.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
And my follow-up to this, then, is since these one or two incidences, has have all bus companies, maybe if you can speak on behalf of them, have they increased training and awareness for these type of situations?
Very much so, Mr. Chair, Urbison Vanderson, very much so. I think in addition to what had normally been going on, I think the technology that we're describing with the button is relatively new. I know, as a matter of course, the companies that I represent, the School Bus Operators Association, aren't real fond of retrofitting $100,000 buses. However, this issue is very important to them, and they have been retrofitting their buses with this technology. And very much encouraging, as I said, one of the companies has a policy where the driver must, you know, turn over a sign that says that bus is empty. And, you know, people will know which bus didn't get checked because they log them out by the bus number with the driver. So people know who was responsible for each bus.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
One final follow-up. If a driver currently without this statute messes up and fails to check or report, what happens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I've heard that in some cases the driver is fired on the spot. But I think the companies that I represent want that prerogative to choose what's an appropriate penalty for their employees based on the specific infraction. You know, I would like to thank the State Patrol because I think this was originally a gross misdemeanor whether a child was left on the bus or not. And we talked and thought that a misdemeanor for failure to do a post-trip inspection when a child isn't left on the bus is a misdemeanor that seemed somewhat reasonable.
Thank you for that.
Representative Slice.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rondrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, just another sort of way to look at this. I mean, you could make the case, you know, that the bus, if it happens, this dreadful situation, it would be the result of the bus company doing insufficient training, you know, a poor job of hiring, recruiting, what have you. I mean, you know, you could make the case that the bus company should suffer a severe penalty. You know, I mean, there's several ways to look at it, and I just, you know, you just wonder if this is the right way. I don't know if the MnDOT folks had thought of that, or State Patrol had thought of another angle.
Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee, I'll address a couple things here. First off, typically the drivers do get fired, but that doesn't keep them from just going down to the next bus company and getting another job. They got their endorsement, and I understand that the hiring qualified and quality bus drivers is a challenge, but at the same hand, somebody that's not doing their job and checking for kids, are they a quality, qualified driver? You know, I question that. So the question was asked earlier, why is it a misdemeanor for the district or operator not to report the violation? All of our other school bus violations are misdemeanors. We wanted to maintain the consistency there, and there are violations for mandatory reporting and failing to report for people that don't do that. So, again, we do put that back on the carrier that if it does happen, to let us know. In our training manual that we do and have been tasked by the legislature to put together, we do address the requirements for driver's training and student management, which include post-trip inspections. So we do what we can, but obviously it still happens. And in MSBOA's own newsletter last month, they referenced this issue, and they did a study in Indiana, and they found that there was 20 cases of kids being left on a bus every year. Now, there's just a few that we know about in Minnesota each year. I've asked our own Department of Education if they get reports or track it. They do get reports, but they don't have a database that they can quickly access the information of a code for how many kids were left on a bus. So it is an issue not just here but everywhere, and we're just trying to address it.
Mr. Kelleher?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just one more quick comment. I understand Lieutenant Rue talking about things happening in Illinois, that there were 20 instances, but there's not a description of time, circumstance, and the way it happened. And as I said in the beginning, MSBOA, the School Bus Operators Association, does not want to get into a debate about, you know, leaving children on a bus and all that sort of stuff. I mean, this bill was first described as the department's housekeeping bill, and then this provision sort of popped up a little later. So, I mean, this obviously has a certain amount of controversy to it, and that that we're trying to make some suggestions that we feel can make it a little more palatable for us. And, you know, I think the sanctions on the drivers still exist in our appropriately, you know, and somewhat draconian in their way, but, you know, given the subject matter, it's hard to make an argument about that.
Representative Slicer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I mentioned earlier, and I want to reiterate that the vast majority of our bus drivers and our carriers, everyone involved, does a great job, and thousands of children get safely delivered every day, which is a wonderful thing. And I'm sure that training has been beefed up, I have no doubt. However, I think in your packet you should have a packet that looks like this. And it reports incidences as currently as December 12th of 2013, just a few months ago, where a child, it was not in a heated garage, and the child was found half a block away, it's on the second page, attempting to get into a car that looked like her mother's. So, you know, I'm very happy. Initially, the bill came to me, and it was a gross misdemeanor no matter what, and I think that is draconian. But I just think that having that knowledge that you just have to make sure, it's not rocket science, you just have to make sure that the children are off the bus. This is an extra incentive, and I think it's a very serious issue in the rare instances that it happens.
Are we ready for a vote? Oh, Representative Beard, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move to a vote, I want the committee to help, Lieutenant, to help the committee understand what it is we're asking for here, and I'm sorry I missed your opening comments. But, for instance, Lieutenant, a speeding ticket is, I think, a civil infraction, but a DWI is a criminal act, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Well, a speeding ticket is a petty misdemeanor, but it still goes on your driving record.
Yes.
It's still a criminal offense.
It is a criminal offense.
But it's not, I wouldn't say it's civil, is my understanding.
Right. Well, Mr. Chairman, and if I may just continue, because... you know, and when thinking about what we're doing here, you know, we've got DWIs or gross misdemeanors are up usually until you have multiples in it because in a felony mode. But as I understand, somebody not walking through the bus at this time, it's a petty misdemeanor. Is that right, or is it a misdemeanor? And at what time does jail time start? I guess that's where I'm going with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, currently there is nothing in statute requiring a post-trip inspection. So there's no requirement for the driver to check for children being left on the bus. And you're right, there's different levels of DWIs, and that's partly where we went with this initially, to differentiate between you don't do the check or you don't do a check and there is a child left on the bus. Obviously, it's more severe there, and that's where it bumped up to the gross misdemeanor. Just to differentiate between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're losing the school bus endorsement, you can refer just to that particular part, not the entire section of just not doing the check. As far as losing the school bus endorsement and the time frame goes, if somebody gets four speeding tickets or four moving violations within 3 years, they lose their school bus endorsement for a year. So that's kind of where we got that from, where if you get a DWI, you lose your school bus endorsement for 5 years.
Okay.
So that can maybe explain, I know a question earlier about where the 1 year came from.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, we're heading in that direction, but I guess I'm thinking about the severity of a gross misdemeanor for somebody not doing the school bus, the walkthrough on the bus. As I understand, though, the amendment that was offered says if they don't do the walkthrough and somebody's actually left on the bus, then we're in a gross misdemeanor. Does that mean that bus driver's then going to jail if he's convicted of that, he or she?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, members of the committee, it's my understanding that would be up to the determination of the courts as what the actual penalty or fine or sentence would be.
It could be, though, up to what and what?
It could be up to a year for any gross misdemeanor offense.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thanks. That, I think, sheds a little light on what we're actually trying to do here. So,
you know, I missed that last answer. But
well,
you get
Mr.
That?
Chair, I think my intent was to help the committee understand that this just isn't raising a fine from $35 to $300. There's actually jail time involved with this offense. And I'm wondering if this needs to go to civil law, I think, is where Representative Runbeck is thinking about. Because if there's jail time involved, this just doesn't go to education finance then to the floor. If we're adding a new jail, new prison penalty here, that would be my suggestion to the chair.
Counsel, how do you feel about that?
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's fair to say that typically the Judiciary or Public Safety Committees have heard bills that involve a penalty of a misdemeanor or higher.
I think they said yes. Are we done then with the conversation? And Representative Peterson. Newberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify, as we're working through the final process of this bill here in committee, the grand picture that I'm getting is we have the large school, we have the large bus company, we have the big fleet of buses that are transporting large numbers of kids in a metro or a larger community setting. I just want to clarify this. Would this also apply, this statute, would this also apply to part-time or volunteer drivers? And what I'm getting at is there are a lot of smaller schools or even your larger schools where you'll have a teacher, you'll have a parent, you'll have a coach, you'll have a choir director who will take kids on a field trip, let's say to choir, music, sports, that kind of thing. So would this standard also apply to a teacher who volunteers to drive the bus to a hockey game or some other school-sponsored event? And if so, how does this play out? Is there a delineation here between professional drivers and volunteers, or is this kind of a one-size-fits-all type of ruling or statute?
Officer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newberger, are you referring to the child left behind or the child checking for the unattended child? That would be to any bus driver. Whoever's driving the route at the end of the trip needs to check that vehicle to make sure no child is left unattended. And essentially, this is just regarding the school bus endorsed drivers. So that really wouldn't have an effect on somebody that doesn't have school bus endorsement driving the other vehicles as far as losing their endorsement, because they don't need an endorsement to drive the smaller type A vehicles, not on school or not on home to school to home trips, or the type 3 vehicles. Again, they'd still be required to conduct the check to make sure no children are left, but there'd be no bearing on their driver's license.
More? I think we ought to change the records and send you to Judiciary.
I think you're right. Thank you. And I want to thank Representative Beard and Representative Rombeck for bringing that forward.
Would you like to make that motion if we are
stage? Yes. I'd like to recommend that we re-refer House File 2481 to, would it be, could you help the freshman, Judiciary, Civil Law, what would it be?
I don't know. What? Judiciary. Tell me. All in favor of that motion, signify saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
All right, you're on your way to Judiciary then. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
She's got a business too. These are... Representative Schwatzky, would you like to move your bill so we can talk about it?
I would, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2214. This is a thank you for hearing this bill. I'm Mary Schwatzky, and I bring this to you from MnDOT agency housekeeping bill. And I have Eric Rudin here to walk through each section of the bill.
Representative Schwatzky, would you like to do amendments? I see you have a couple here.
Yes. May we move H2214A2?
All in favor of attaching that to the bill, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And you have another one here.
Yes, H221484.
What? Yeah. I think the motion prevailed.
What?
That's H221482. And the next amendment is H221484.
Yes.
You're going to move that one?
Yes.
No questions or answers are given at this time.
And if you have questions or answers?
There's some money changes in this one. Could somebody give us a brief explanation about where the amendment came from and what the changes mean?
We have somebody here from the department. Oh, Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment A4 reflects some of the changes are actually technical that were suggested by Mr. Burris, including the money change on the bottom there. There's a provision in the bill to move some bond appropriations from one phase of a project in Rochester to the second phase. And Mr. Burris was good enough to catch that we need to change the bond sales that were tied to those bond appropriations. So I can explain that in more detail as I go through the bill, but I think this is just kind of a conforming amendment to another provision that's in the bill. The amendment also reflects some changes that are being made to address concerns of Associated General Contractors. We're deleting several sections of the bill that they had a small concern with.
Okay.
I'm satisfied. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will, you want to vote on that? We have the amendment here up for consideration, H221484. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You now have a whole bill which includes H221484 as well as your first amendment. Go ahead and explain it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just briefly walk through the bill section by section. Section 1 of the bill puts into statute a definition of receipt of an invoice, means the receipt approved by an architect or engineer. There had been some confusion about when an invoice was due on a project, and so this will help just clarify when payments are due to contractors. The second portion in Section 1 states that with the amendment that was just adopted, that interest does not accrue on claims made by contractors under this section of statute. There is a separate section of statute in the Trunk Highway Contracting section where those interest penalties would continue to accrue if appropriate. But we have had a few cases where contractors were claiming interest under both sections of statute, which we don't think was the intent. Sections 2, 4, 5, 6, and 7 were just deleted by the A4 amendment, so I won't go through those sections. Section 3 of the bill relates to a current provision in law that requires MnDOT to wait for 60 days before pursuing remedies under a construction contract. If there is a fault found on a construction contract under current law, the contractor has 60 days to address those. And MnDOT feels that 60 days is an unusually long period of time and that we can delete the 60-day provision in statute and address that through each standard specification in each individual contract. The day that we're proposing to move to is 15 days. Typically, if we have problems with a contractor, they're known long before we actually have to kick that contractor off the project. And waiting 60 days and then trying to find another contractor to come in and address those issues is, we think, an unreasonably long period of time. Section 8 of the bill deals with a provision that was enacted last year requiring the department to periodically identify land that is no longer needed for transportation purposes and can be sold. There was a restriction put on that provision saying that if there's a bike ped facility or a potential for a future bike ped facility, that MnDOT could not convey that land to another sector of government or to a private developer. So we're proposing that as long as there's some sort of deed restriction or other means of protecting that bicycle pedestrian facility, that we in fact be authorized to transfer the land to a local government or in some limited cases even a private developer if they've agreed to construct a bicycle or pedestrian facility. Sections 9 and 10 of the bill deal with accruals to state aid funds to cities and counties. Currently, those are based on 5 months of actual receipts and 7 months of estimated receipts. We're proposing to go up to 12 months of estimated receipts. Our estimating capabilities have improved to the point that we can let cities and counties know much earlier in the process how much money they would be entitled to from the state aid funds, and so this should be a benefit to cities and counties to get this information earlier. Sections 11 and 12 deal with instances where a county performs an inspection on a township bridge, which they are required to do, but then if an issue is found on that inspection, there's been some confusion over who is responsible for doing what under the law. And so sections 11 and 12 clarify the duties and responsibilities of the county to remedy the issues that were found in the bridge inspection. And this language has been agreed to between the counties and the township association. Sections 13 and 14 of the bill deal with turning movements, making right turns and U-turns at what we call reduced conflict intersections. And you should have one of these graphics that's been distributed. These are intersections that we've begun installing on mostly rural four-lane expressways. And rather than allowing traffic to directly cross the intersection or to make a left turn at the intersection, the traffic is required to make a right turn and then make a U-turn. And this greatly reduces the number of conflict points at the intersections and is a much safer type of traffic movement. However, the statutes currently require you to turn into the closest lane of traffic. And when you make a U-turn, you also have to turn into the closest lane of traffic, and that's not physically possible for larger vehicles like semis or farm equipment. And so we're just looking to clarify those sections of statute, and we ran these changes by the State Patrol as well. Several sections of the bill, 15 through 19, and then 22, 23, and 28, all deal with motor carrier regulations for agricultural vehicles. You might remember that last session there was an effort at the end of session to update state law to reflect the new federal transportation bill, MAP 21, which included some additional exemptions for agriculture vehicles. There wasn't time at the end of last session because the federal rules hadn't been finalized to really detail what those changes should be, and so a provision was enacted directing public safety to refrain from enforcing state laws that were in conflict with the federal law. So what this legislation does is bring state law up to date and into conformance with all of those federal changes regarding covered farm vehicles and sizes of vehicles, hauling distances, cargo that's being transported. So Mr. Chair, I wasn't planning to go through those in great detail, but just suffice it to say that those are all bringing our state law up to date and in conformance with the new federal law. Section 20 of the bill allows transportation economic development funds to be used until expended. There have been a couple of appropriations to that account, and some of the money is available until expended, while the other appropriation was not, and so we just believe that it would be appropriate to have all of those funds available until expended. Section 21 of the bill extends the Non-Motorized Transportation Advisory Committee, which is scheduled to expire this June 30th, for an additional 4 years. This committee advises the commissioner on issues related to non-motorized transportation, such as bicycling and pedestrians. Sections 24 and 25 are what we were talking about earlier with the A4 amendment. It shifts some appropriations for the Rochester remodel of the headquarters and the maintenance facility down there by $1.493 million between the two appropriations. So there's a net zero impact of this change, but the first portion of the project came in a little bit under budget, and the second phase of the project is a little bit over what we had anticipated, and so we're proposing to shift those appropriations. And Section 26 of the bill makes a correction to a previous appropriation for trunk highway work related to flooding. In 2007, there was a cancellation of some unneeded appropriations for that flood work. Unfortunately, that cancellation was overstated, and so this legislation corrects that cancellation. Section 27 of the bill amends a turn back that was enacted last year for Highway 66 in Blue Earth County. The city of Mankato would like to have the portion that's in the city turned directly over to them. The plan originally was to give the entire portion to the county, and then the county was going to turn that portion over to the city that was within the city limits. But by doing it this way, there may be some additional benefits to the city for accessing turnback accounts. And my understanding is that the city is also ready to proceed immediately with their turnback, whereas the county may not be. And then finally, in Section 28A, we're repealing the legislative designation of Highway 309, which served the Brainerd State Hospital. That hospital is closed. The property is owned by the Department of Administration, but the former highway has been actually been removed. A portion of it, about two-thirds of the highway, has already been removed. What's left is really just serving as a driveway to the land that is up there, and Department Administration is willing to take over custodial control of that section of former state highway. That's a very brief overview of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, we've got another half hour. Would you like to go make it a little longer?
No, that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can ask a question. You were talking about the committee, Advisory Committee on Non-Motorized Transportation. Just more a point of interest, I mean, how does someone in your agency monitor the meetings of that committee? Are there reports we could you know, access and learn what they're reporting on and discussing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and sure. Representative Runbeck. Somebody from our transit office does staff the committee, and mm-hmm. they do issue reports. They have a website which contains the previous reports that have been issued. If you'd like, they're fairly simple to find. Otherwise, I'd be happy to email you that link if you'd like to look at their previous work.
Other questions or comments? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rudin or Representative Swatsky, and I see the patrol just left. I've got a couple questions about these exemptions for farm vehicles. When I chaired this committee, we got all tangled up in what the patrol was doing to the farmers and the farm trucks and things like that. I'm glad to see we're actually codifying some of the exemptions. At least I think that's what's happening here. But, Mr. Chair, I know Mr. Clevin might want to speak to this too, but particularly I'm on the top of page 15.1. We're going to exempt them from certain inspections, repairs, and maintenance. And I'm sure that he'll assure us that they're not interested in putting dangerous trucks on the road. That's not the point. My point is, are we going to exempt them from getting pulled over the side of the road and getting the commercial department putting them through the 32-point safety check or whatever it is they do when they pull commercial vehicles over? That's where I'm going. Does this exempt them from that or to give them some relief on that situation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, the bill exempts farm vehicles, certain covered farm vehicles, from their annual inspection and from a daily inspection. And so that is relief for those vehicles that they currently had to be subject to those inspections. The bill actually does not address at all a roadside inspection, which I think is what you're also referring to. The state patrol or law enforcement has authority today to pull any vehicle over and perform a roadside inspection. This bill does not change that, and my understanding is there was no nothing directly in the federal legislation that would exempt vehicles from those types of roadside inspections. I think that law enforcement would tell you it's important that they be able to have some authority to, if they see an unsafe vehicle on the road that they feel is posing a danger to the public, to be able to, you know, do a visual inspection on that vehicle and address that. But I believe that Mr. Klavan does want to address this issue as well.
Mr. Chair, may I have asked Mr. Klavan if he'd talk about this for a moment?
Okay.
Yeah, he's here to...
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Klavan. I'm a lobbyist for a number of the ag groups here, wheat growers, barley, all three sugar companies, turkeys, and so forth. I also know the Farm Bureau and the union also have interest in this issue. I had told Representative Swalski we were supportive of her bill and appreciated her bringing this forward. This is something we have to do according to federal law. And the issue I've raised with the department was exactly what you had asked, Representative Beard. How does this relate to the roadside component? As farm groups, we don't advocate unsafe trucks. In fact, we partner with the patrol, and I've written a couple books for the guys to keep in their cabs, which is a compliance book. It's not a way to get out of the rules. It's a way to comply with the rules. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be updating that book this year, this summer, after the interim, or after we get done here. And the interface is between what you asked. How does this relate to the roadside inspection? Because they're going to ask me what to do. And I'm trying to seek the clarification from that. The federal law just simply says the farm vehicles are exempt from inspection, repair, and maintenance. And so I've tried to figure out how that interfaces with the roadside. I haven't seen anything from the memos from the feds. There maybe is one. I know these two sections, 15 and 16, we have to do. So we're trying to figure that out before the floor. I hope someone has the answer, but we need to update our book so we can comply with the rules. There's a second part to that, and Chairman Hornstein will be interested in this. We have to make sure we get this right, because if we're out of compliance with the feds, we risk, at least the old number used to be $4 million of federal funding. The ag groups had brought bills over the years that would have been out of compliance on USDOT numbers, and we did bumpers 1 year. We had a 2-year inspection sticker that had to become a 1-year. There's been 3-4 of them in my tenure here. And we've always been told that if we're out of compliance with the feds, we risk the money. So you just want to make sure you get this right, and that's why I've raised the issue. It's not to get out of anything. It's to make sure we're in compliance with the feds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that sheds a little light on what we're doing here today and some of the complexities of dealing with the federal code. And I think that line 15.1, when it refers to Section 221.0314, Subdivision 10, actually refers to Federal Code of Federal Regulations, doesn't it? It doesn't refer to Minnesota state statutes. Line 15.1.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I think that is a reference to Minnesota statutes.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay.
Are we ready for a vote on this? And it would be headed for Transportation Finance.
So we'll get one more look at it in finance? Okay, I'm ready to vote then. Thanks, Mr.
All right. Would you, Representative Swatsky, or I'll make the, I recommend that House File 2214 be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to Transportation Finance. Thank you. What? Recommend? Okay. Representative Simonson, would you like to announce your bill so we have it on the table here for discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, do you know where this bill is going to go to next?
I think it's Transportation Finance.
Okay. Then I would make a motion that House File 2728 be re-referred to Transportation Finance.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, this is a, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to spare you my comments and very simply turn it over to Ms. McCormick to talk about the details of the bill, and then I'll save my comments for the end.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And in this bill, we are addressing various provisions that relate to driver's licenses and permits. The first section deals with a motorized bicycle permit. And currently, at this time, we issue an operator permit that's valid for 1 year for $6.75, and that's paid for at the time that the operator is taking their skills test. When the operator passes that test, then they are applying for the motorized bicycle operator's permit at the DL agent office so that they can get a card with a photo. The current law then requires that after 1 year they have to complete a renewal application and pay $9.75 for a renewed permit, which would be valid for until the age of 21. And if the operator is over 21 and has had the 1 year permit, then they can receive a permit that's valid for 4 years. What DVS is proposing is that we modify the permit fees to eliminate the 1 year operator permit and make it an under 21 operator permit that's valid until the age of 21 and set a $5.25 fee for all duplicate permits, and the fee for the motorized bicycle or moped permit would be $9.75 for 3 years. So we believe that's a much more streamlined process, and we think that this would resolve issues with people having to come back in to renew after 1 year with their permit. The second provision within this legislation sets a $2.50 fee for a learner's permit for a commercial driver's license, and this would be a tamper-proof photo permit, and that would be, we are just setting the fee at $2.50 just to pay for the cost to produce the permit, and then there's also in addition to that an $8 filing fee that would be paid when you go to the deputy registrar or the DL agent's office to apply for that permit. The third provision deals with commercial driver's license and federal conformity. As was discussed with the bill you just previously heard, federal transportation laws require that the state governments must be able to comply with federal regulations. And in this case, we're talking about the Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, complying with the federal regulations from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Federal laws do take precedence in the event of conflicts, as is stated in the summary you have before you. This would allow the department to keep CDL programs in compliance with federal regulations. Currently, we have several provisions within the statutes that do refer to these regulations, which are in 49 CFR 383, and that would be what DVS is requesting, that we be allowed to have that so that we can ensure that we are staying in compliance with the federal regulations. As was stated earlier, there's a penalty for the department not to be in compliance with FMCSA, and it's a 4% of federal transportation funds, which is $26 million. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Is Ms. McCormick, is the $5.25 fee says for all duplicate permits? Does that mean just if they lost it, Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, it would be for if you lost it or if you'd moved to a different address. Would be the two things that you would get a duplicate for, whether you have a different residence.
You don't automatically have to buy one every year.
Just Mr. Chair, no, this would not require you to have to buy one the way the current law reads.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments? Representative Runbeck, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McCormick, on the motorized bicycle operator permit, what is the penalty then if you don't have one? If you're operating one and do not have the permit?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I'm not absolutely positive of that. I think it would probably be driving without a license for that vehicle, and so that would probably lead to a suspension. If you're talking about, Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, if you're talking about what would happen in terms of being ticketed, I'm not familiar with that, but I'd be glad to find out and report back to the committee and to you.
Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I'm assuming that because this is a state-sponsored license, that would then qualify then as a legal identification as well, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that would be correct.
Any other questions or comments? No, you're all set to go, Representative. So we got to renew our motion here that House File 2728 recommended to be referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. On your way to Transportation Finance. Oh, are you back again? Oh, heavens. Representative Zohol, House File 1865.
Yes, I'd like to move to refer House File 1865 to the Register, Mr. Chair.
Government Operations.
I'm sorry, Government Operations. I'll be there, too.
Okay.
Basically, what you have in front of here is just a bill that's shrinking two committees that have always met as one committee into one committee, and we do have a quality testifier to explain that in more details if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Eric
Rudine,
MnDOT Government Affairs. The bill combines language for two separate state aid rules advisory committees into one section of statute. The committee has always actually met and functioned as one advisory committee. However, there is separate language in the county section of statute and the city section of statute, and so kind of in line with the unsession and cleaning up the statutes, it would probably be more appropriate to just have one section of statute where this rules committee is referred to. There is one other provision in the bill repealing the commuter rail corridor advisory committee, and Mr. Chair, there is no commuter rail corridor currently under development. This committee was established to advise the commissioner on the route for the North Star commuter rail project, and obviously that project was constructed, and so it wasn't felt that this committee, that the language authorizing this committee is needed to still be in statute. It hasn't been operational for I think about 5 years. So this, I should mention too, that this is something that the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy came up with these ideas as part of their review of all advisory committees to executive branch agencies.
Well, Isn't the committee that is overlooking the Southwest Light Rail called what you're just getting rid of there, or no?
No, Mr. Chair. There may be some other language in the Met Council section of statute. I'm not sure, but that is not a commuter rail project. That's a light rail project, and so
this is specific
to commuter rail.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Udine. So let's say the North Star gets, for example, hypothetically, there's a extension of the North Star, or let's say someone brings back the Dan Patch line. What would you...
Just a minute.
What would you...
You're out of order.
Hypothetically. there's a serious question here, Mr. Chairman. Would you have to reconstitute this committee? Would the legislature decide that it's needed? Or how would this work? Because we're not... The bottom line is we're not done with... I hope we're not done with commuter rail in the state. So I think it's a good thing to have an advisory committee. I think it provides the legislature and you with, local, county commissioners and city council members and other stakeholders. So what do you envision if we move forward with other lines?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I think in the case of North Star, this committee would not need to meet again. My understanding of the role of this committee is to help to provide input on the route that a project would take, and in the case of North Star, even if the line is extended, that route has already been identified, and so there would be really no work for this type of committee to do. But you're right that for a future rail project, Red Rock Corridor is another project that's been discussed. There would be a point in time where a committee of this type would be valuable to provide that public input. And so at that time, I suspect that the department would potentially come forward to the legislature to ask that a committee be reestablished. I've been told as well that, the commissioner could choose to establish a committee to take this sort of public input, even if there was no specific language in statute directing that. But I think you're right that if the legislature feels it's appropriate to, to have this sort of public involvement in the process, that either it would have to be reenacted at a future point in time, or you could choose to leave it on the books now, and it obviously wouldn't meet and wouldn't function until such time as there is another commuter rail project in the planning stages.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments on this?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dean. Okay, so the bottom line is this is taking it out, but if we want to look at commuter rail again, we have to come up with another committee, so why would we do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, you might be looking at somebody who wants to extend the train all the way to St. Cloud and hopefully Rice. I've been in conversations with the Department of Transportation and others where when we do expand rails, that it would be a different idea than a committee, such as this one here. This one has established some routes, if that makes sense, and we know where the trains are going to go. Hasn't met in 5 years, and when we do approach expanding commuter rail, as we hope we do, it will be slightly different from the way this committee operates, from what I understand and from the conversations I've had. Because when I first saw this, of course, my eyes were pretty wide until we had several conversations, because I want that train to come all the way to St. Cloud.
Representative Mason?
Mr. Chair, members, there was a group of high school students today from Burnsville, and one of the questions was on what are we going to do about the future of railroads? So I told them, we're not doing very much right now, but we could sure use their support going forward.
Representative Rundrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this advisory committee is really dealing with the routes of LRT?
Which
is
no.
No.
Mr. Chair.
It's rules. I'm sorry. No. Okay, rules. But it's very specific to a couple subdivisions. So why are they only writing rules pertaining to a couple of subdivisions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbach, for the State Aid Rules Advisory Committee, are you referring to? Mm-hmm. There's separate statutory language that's referred to on 1.9 that govern the operations of the county state aid highway system and the municipal state aid street system. And so before those rules are modified, the commissioner is instructed to consult with cities and counties and to establish this group so that they can help provide input on how the rules ought to be updated. And so they're specific to the rules about that state aid transportation system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Rudin, so then does MnDOT have a number of other advisory committees that they consult with about rule writing on many other aspects of roads and bridges?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbach, I don't believe there are separate advisory committees, but if the department were involved in writing or amending state rules, we would follow the Administrative Procedures Act in Chapter 14, which spells out the public consultation process and public notification process for rulemaking. And so these state aid rules are actually exempt from the requirements of that act, and so that's why there's this separate advisory council that's established to provide input on state aid rules.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is rail. This is government. I mean, so, but anyway, I just have one more question on that commuter rail. Is CTIB and Met Council okay with this, and you discussed this with them?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, we did run this by the Met Council, and they were comfortable with repealing this. I don't know whether they specifically asked CTIB for their opinion.
Okay. Thank you.
Are we done? You want to renew your motion to Representative Doherholt?
Sure. Mr. Chair, renew my motion to refer HF 1865 to government operations.
All in favor, signify by aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to government operations. And I think, is there anything else? I think we will adjourn.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I wanted to inquire. I had inquired last week about a photographer who was in the committee hearing a week ago, Thursday. It wasn't anyone I recognized. It wasn't a house photographer. Do we know? Does the committee know? It seems like the committee should know who it was. And would you share that with the rest of us?
Anybody know? Matt says that he thinks they were videotaping the 494 presentation, but he doesn't know who it is. Were they press, you mean, or something, or what?
Right, and he had a video camera on a tripod. Okay. It would be good to know. I mean, I just think that, you know, there's certain protocol, and the press, of course, has access when there's certain issues. And he was not, to my knowledge, it wasn't a press member of the press.
I happen to know who he is from
the press. Okay. Okay, that'd be great if you would share that with us. Thank you.
Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you.